What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. For over three decades, the SAT has been used as a way to screen potentially successful students for college entrance. Often referred to as the big test, the SAT is a real rite of passage. 44% of the kids who graduated from high school took the SAT. But the ACT, long an underdog of the college testing world, has become part of the mainstream. The ACT is a standardized test for high school achievement and college admission in the United States. All four-year colleges in the U.S. now accept ACT scores. Elizabeth King, author of Acing the ACT, delivers lessons that focus on what students need to know, how test designers test questions, and the core knowledge that will radically improve ACT scores. Elizabeth, welcome to 411 Team.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for coming. How do you feel about standardized testing overall?
I don't actually have a stance on standardized testing as far as I know it's a hot-button issue in Florida in particular, but I know that the SAT and the ACT in particular are sort of, I don't want to call them even necessary evils, but they're necessities in that they're one of the only ways that colleges are able to compare students on their performance on exactly the same material. So while many schools are going test optional, I think we're going to be seeing a lot of the SAT and ACT for a long time.
Okay. So do you feel like they provide valid information about the student?
I feel like they provide valid information about students on their performance on those tests.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, on those tests, SAT and ACT. Yeah.
That's right.
Okay. So you think the scores are an accurate reflection of student ability and performance?
I think that the scores, now this is something that, like, my opinion is almost not even relevant because it's something that's been studied by economists for a long time, and we all know that there are many disconnects between the relationship between a student's ACT score and an SAT score and what their college performance may look like. There's very little connection between those scores, but no matter how any of us feels about it, the score, whatever score you get, is going to influence what school you get into. And at the end of the day, that's what matters to me, is helping students make sure that they get a score that reflects their very best performance on that test.
Right, and I understand that completely. In looking, because I know you've written about both of them, you've written about the SAT and you've written about the ACT, and, you know, have some knowledge, have a real base on what what they accomplish and what they do. In looking at them and how they are used, both ACT and SAT, do you think that they are used accurately in college admissions? Now, I know the ACT has moved up a step now. And
I think that there's a reason that the ACT actually has overtaken the SAT.
Okay, share
and
that.
I think that's probably a two-part thing. For one, it's taken over market share because students are more comfortable with it. Because the ACT much more closely reflects the sort of work that students do in school anyway. So while the SAT, and while we all know the SAT is changing, so I'm going to talk about the SAT in its present iteration. In its present iteration, there's a lot more, confusing, tricky IQ test-ish sorts of questions. Whereas on the ACT, it's very much a critical reading, grammar, math, and science reasoning test. And I find that students object to it a lot less because they feel like they're being tested on things that they've seen in these same forms in school. In which case, yeah, I, especially on the math, like, the math, although there are specific, of course, my book only addresses these really kind of tricky ACT-specific question styles, mm-hmm. but I think it's pretty safe to say that overall, the ACT asks math questions that a student who's on a college prep track should have seen in one form mm-hmm. or another, or seen mm-hmm. related, mm-hmm. Seen related questions prior. So it's very unusual for me to look at the ACT with a student and have them say, oh, I've never seen anything like this mm-hmm. before, unless I've actually not had the course to which that question is actually related. So in which case, I don't think it's necessarily that unfair. I think that you just have to know what you're going into in terms of the way that the test presents itself, the pacing that you need to have, and really knowing what you need to know. Most students don't have all of this information top of mind just going in the test. And that's where preparation really comes into play.
Acing the ACT, what was the impetus for your writing this book?
What was the impetus? Well, I mean, quite matter-of-factly, I wrote a book called Outsmarting the SAT.
I know.
Mm-hmm. It came out in 2008. And it's kind of an underground hit. Mm-hmm. I get fan mail all the time from all over the world from students saying, thank you so much for writing this. It's been incredibly actually useful and helpful. So I feel like I have sort of an unusual and special take on these tests. Of course, naturally, the ACT has more market share than the SAT now. And I find that even though I'm known as an SAT expert, my students, more of my students take the ACT than the SAT. So just as Outsmarting the SAT was born out of my original notes that I was sharing with students on an ongoing basis, so the ACT has become kind of this divulging little black book of, here are the secrets that I share with students all over the world. So it seems only fair. I only have so many hours in the day, and only so many students have access to me in person. So it seemed like a fun idea to get all the secrets out on the table.
In looking at your book, how does your book compare to other tutor-like books? And I say that just for the listening audience so they would know, you know, the difference and maybe which book to select, because it is different.
Sure, it is different. I'm glad that you see that it's different. It's very different. Mm-hmm. I think that, I can really get into this, so I don't want to unpack it too much, but I think that students are very, I know that the word strategy is on the cover of my book, mm-hmm. but I think that when we think about test prep strategy, that word kind of triggers everybody. It's very overwhelming, and it makes you think, oh no, I'm not educated enough, I'm not prepared enough, I don't know what I'm doing. If this test requires strategy, then it has to be this overwhelming, scary, psychological mess of a test. What am I going to do? And I think student scores actually go down just from feeling that way. So I am very, very against general test strategy because I don't find that it's very effective. Most test prep is not actually that effective. And instead, what's effective is developing real connoisseurship, which is understanding what's on the test, what you know, what you don't know, and how to attack those problems. So I'm famous for saying the only three reasons that you would ever get a standardized test question wrong are, one, you actually don't know the material that's being tested. Okay. You don't know the geometry formula, or you don't know the grammar rule. Mm-hmm. Sometimes on the tricky questions, we do know the information that we need to take that question, but the way that the question was presented instead kind of got us. And that's where students get into that tricky question psychology. Mm-hmm. So I really focus on making sure that students have their fundamentals in a row. I think that they don't always realize how much stuff they've forgotten because they don't use it on a daily basis. And then I show them those places where, oh, you do know what you need. There's just a way that they're expressing this problem that's gotcha. And that's mm-hmm. developing your connoisseurship. And then three is just tracking your human error, right? We all make mistakes. And I never let my students actually set a goal of a perfect score on any test, even though they do sometimes achieve them, simply because it doesn't really matter. You could get a perfect score and still not get into Princeton or Harvard. And simultaneously, that kind of pressure means that you forget to track your own humanity and take it into account as something that's sort of inevitable. So this book is all about, here are your fundamentals. there is a weird way that they test fundamentals and the things that you as a regular student instead of a test maker may not think about the ways that things that seem really straightforward may trick you in some way or another.
Well, I think you said something that was really very important and insightful, and that was you can get a perfect score and still not be admitted to the school, you know, of your choice. And that's because
right.
There are other components, there are other variables that the admissions counselor looks at, evaluates, and looking at admission.
That's right. But I think it's also, sometimes I have students that, I actually had a student that was admitted to FSU this year, and she decided to go back and take the ACT again so that she could secure her full Bright Futures scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of reasons to take the test. There are a lot of different reasons to set different score goals. And I think they're all reasonable, and they can all be taken into account. But I like to approach these tests with a real sense of reality for what they're useful for, and using them as a way to learn how to study and learn how to teach yourself, and then finding real school skills that you can use once you get to college, because that's the whole point anyway. So I like to make it as useful as possible.
I think I know what you may say, but I'm going to ask you, because this is a question several students have asked me, explore. Do you feel like test-taking classes that teach you how to take a test, how to take a multiple-guess test or multiple-choice test, do you feel that they can help in taking these tests? And I mean, for example, you have four options in a multiple choice. Usually you have four. Sometimes I know that you have five. And in the class, it may teach you automatically there should be two options that you can eliminate right off the top.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know that two of them are really wrong, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then the strategies that are involved in just even the nomenclature or the wording of the question. If they use absolutes, always, never, well, you know that's not right, because nothing is ever always or absolute. And so what I'm asking you, do you feel like this type of strategy class is effective? I'm going to ask you to hold your thoughts because we are going to take a brief break, but when we come back, we'll explore that. You're tuned into 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and their parents and teachers and other interested folks. This hour, I'm talking with Elizabeth King, author and test preparation expert. We're going to take a brief break, but we will return momentarily. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I'm talking with Elizabeth King, author and test preparation expert. Elizabeth, right before we went on break, I was asking you about these test-taking classes that give you various strategies, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to respond.
Well, I want to talk about this in two ways.
Okay.
There's the class, and there's the use of the strategy that you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
I am absolutely 110% in support of the strategy that you are describing. And I think most people stink at it if they haven't been taught how to do it.
Right.
And in fact, even in the use of absolutes that you were talking about, I think that there are lots of absolutes that we don't even realize, like words like original or began.
Mm-hmm.
So on the ACT, if we use the word original, it actually means the very first time an idea or something surfaced. So we tend to conflate original with old or had happened a long time ago. So learning to read words for what they really mean is incredibly important and is a key part of the strategy that you're describing. That being said, when one seeks out that kind of class, you need to make sure that it's being taught by somebody that really knows how to teach that. And I think that's really, really key. So I don't want to plug classes because I think it's very much about the teacher and the teacher's ability to communicate that, but I do think that what you're recommending is 100% useful. And not only that, that kind of thinking is what makes us good critical thinkers when we're in the college classroom, which is, again, the entire point.
In taking these tests, looking at the ACT, because that's what this is all about today, what are we measuring in looking at the ACT from your perspective?
I think we're measuring a bunch of things. We're honest to God, measuring grammar fundamentals. Mm-hmm. We're measuring critical reading and critical thinking. We're measuring math. We're measuring the ability to read graphs and charts and do some basic science reasoning and connection between data. 100% those things are being tested. We're also testing how quickly a student can do those things. And then ultimately, once we get into the 90th percentile and above, we're really testing attention to detail. We're testing connoisseurship. We're testing how much a student can really pay attention to over an extended period of time. Mm-hmm. And all of those things ultimately feed into a score, which is why a score can waver so much with so many students.
How do
they... real things. I think the only thing that's difficult about it is that it's hard to know what the ultimate score is testing, if it's an ability to pay attention
exactly.
or if it's an ability to... you know, to work quickly, or if you really know your fundamentals, or if you're just a really lucky person. And every now and then there's one of them, too.
Well, with the ACT, if I remember correctly, you can you are not penalized for selecting an incorrect answer.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So that remains the same.
The ACT is going to be moving in that direction in the long run.
Oh, are they? Okay.
The new SAT will be the same way.
Okay. Do you feel like test-taking ability plays a role in this?
I kind of think, and no one likes it when I say this, but mm-hmm. I kind of think test-taking ability is a mythological thing. I think that your test-taking ability is, can you manage to not freak out?
Right.
Control your emotions.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And are you studied and prepared? So I don't think that I'm less reluctant to call it test taking ability and maybe mental toughness.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And confidence, which is something that any individual should be striving to develop. And frankly, I try to use that to develop that kind of confidence and mental toughness in my students. I use the test to do so, but then they take it back with them on the squash court and into the classroom and to school and in their futures. You know,
are we placing?
I've been test taking.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking, we are going to get more specific into the ACT. But do you feel like we may be placing too much emphasis on scores?
That's really tough for me to say because I've never worked in admissions.
Okay.
But I have several friends that work in admissions, and they're very clear about how they weigh all of the different ways that scores could or could not be influenced ultimately, or how a student's score could have been influenced.
Do you mind sharing some of those for the listening audience? I think it would be important.
Sure.
Because people are so hung up on scores.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, scores matter. There's no two ways about it. And what's really important is ensuring, when you're applying to college, you're looking to show that you know how to work really hard and that you're prepared to do the coursework that school offers. So you need to look at your test score as an element of a way of proving that. One of the ways that you can do that, and one of the ways it's taken into account, is via resources. If you're a student that comes from a family that has significant financial resources, then you're expected to show a much higher score than somebody that does not, because you have access to preparation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that's sort of fed into, you know, that's kind of the balance of capitalism, is that if you have the resources, you're expected to use it. That being said, no matter what your resources are, and they are taken into account when you're applying to schools, the number that you come out with as compared to your schoolwork, how difficult the courses that you took and the ways that you may have been able to or not been able to prepare yourself for the test all come into play. I think that it's possible that, you know, it's kind of crazy because I'm sort of shooting myself in the foot by talking about it this way, but I honestly also think that, like, it makes me, I'm trustworthy in the way that I talk about this, is that I think the test prep industry, I mean, it's a $1 billion industry. I'm not the lion's share of that by any stretch, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that big industry kind of needs to feed itself. And again, this branding of strategy and points and do you have what it takes, all of those things are really kind of building anxiety. And I think that especially the public discourse, particularly in New York and Florida around the constant testing in K-12, is fueling the general test anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And again, then that starts fueling student anxiety, and it goes on and on and on and on. So absolutely, 100%, this is a major problem. And I'm against that, but I also never want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right.
It's really important to prepare for these tests. It's possible to prepare for them, and it's going to matter. You need to show that you really did your best in the circumstances that you were in. That's what's most important.
Do you think they do you think they distort the educational priorities, especially when you look at this test taking and their scores? Because again, you know, we're talking about students and parents being so concerned about the score, you know?
Well, I don't know if you had the opportunity to look in the back of my book, but it's a book of secrets.
Mm-hmm.
At the very last minute, I threw in what I consider the most important secret.
Yes, I saw that.
Did you see
that? Yes, yes. Let's talk about that most important secret.
I think, you know, it's kind of a crazy thing. And again, it's sort of shooting myself in the foot because, of course, I want people to be really concerned with the industry that I work in. But really, the ACT is not the most important thing. And even I put up a video on YouTube this past week instead of doing a book trailer because it's really kind of hard and boring to talk about the ACT. Instead, I made a video about how the ACT is not actually the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the most important thing is actually learning to embrace challenge and letting things roll off your back and learning to live your life really well as early on as you possibly can and becoming a whole person and practicing kindness. That's actually the most important thing. And I felt like I experienced students who are so distraught and stressed about these tests because they feel like they're reflections of them as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
That even in the back of my own test prep book, I had to raise the red flag and say, hey guys, this is not the be all end all. And hopefully in the long run, you won't even remember what your ACT score is, and nobody else will either.
Some say the problem in you S education is the lack of a standardized curriculum. Someone who is an expert in testing, do you feel a universal curriculum is warranted?
Oh no, you dropped off. I didn't hear your question.
Oh, I said many say that the problem with the education system, the United States, is a lack of a standardized curriculum. And I wondered how you felt about a universal standardized curriculum. Do you think it's warranted or unwarranted or why? I just wanted to get your feeling on that. You know, that's something that we hear so much about today.
Yeah, I mean, I can lob something at that, and I think I kind of have an interesting perspective on that because I really do teach students all over the country who go to all sorts of different schools, as well as students around the globe that are competing with those students. I don't, like, despite the laws of, you know, who's in charge of, you know, states or federal government is in charge of education ultimately, from a practical standpoint, I don't think that it's a terrible idea to have a nationally standardized curriculum, depending on what that curriculum is, because students are competing to go to college and to continue their education all over the country. Mm-hmm. So that level of localization is no longer a reality. So a student in South Florida needs to be able to compete and be prepared in the same way as somebody that's living in California. That's mm-hmm. just the way that it works now. And that kind of communication, I think, would serve students well. The ins and outs of what that curriculum ultimately becomes and then who teaches it is an entirely different thing.
Right.
But I think it's a fair thing to consider from a really practical standpoint. Yeah.
Well, let's look at the ACT, okay? First of all, how often is it administered? It's offered,
great
what?
Great question.
Yeah.
I think about 6 or 7 a year. I don't even know off the top of my head.
Okay.
But about a half a dozen, 5 or 6.
A half a dozen. And do you recommend individual students take it over and over again? Because I've seen some students who have taken, whether it's the ACT or the SAT, they have taken it 2-3 times, okay, trying
that's
to
normal.
Reach. Is
that's
it,
very
that's normal.
Normal?
Okay.
To take it 5 or 6 times would be unusual.
I've seen some.
3 times is very normal, actually.
Okay. So that's normal. No big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, in looking, let's talk about the scoring before we really get into the test. The the highest score is 36, right?
Yes.
Okay. And there are subtests. And mm-hmm. the subtests consist of what? Science, math, reading. What else? What did I leave out? English.
The writing section. Which is
That's right. Writing. Now, the writing section is optional.
Okay. So there's the first section is an English section.
English.
Multiple mm-hmm. choice grammar.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's math, reading, and science. And then there's an optional essay section. Some colleges require the essay, some don't. So you want to look at the school that you're to which you're applying to find out if you need to take the essay.
Mm-hmm.
Most colleges ask for the essay, yes.
Well, now, with the English and the math, would you agree that they largely test what you know as opposed to what reading and science being more application? What's your position on that?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Certainly yes, insofar as the reading tests your ability to get to the same answer as the test maker, right? So that's
mm-hmm.
in some ways just testing your critical thinking. The grammar tests what you know, and then there are maybe half a dozen questions that test maybe 10 to 12 questions that out of 75 that test how well you were really paying attention to detail, if you were able to read the entire passage. So if you're just jumping from question to question or if you're not reading the entire sentences, you won't get things correct. So it tests what you know in a certain feel. Same for the math. The math is, like we said earlier, overall it feels very much like what you would see in school, but maybe 10 to 20% of those questions ask things that you would have learned in school in very weird ways. Whereas the reading and the science are all about, it's much more important to understand
mm-hmm.
your pacing and your how questions are presented in that section and to know what to be on the lookout for. So a lot of what's in acing the ACT feels like that. Here are the facts you need to know, and here's how they ask the questions in the first half, and then the reading and science is very much here's what you need to be on the lookout for, and here's how you need to be thinking while you approach them. But I hesitate to use the word strategy because
mm-hmm.
I don't want to incite fear in the
okay.
student.
Well, then I won't use the word, but I'll say this: some techniques, and you mentioned this, may involve jumping from question to question. I've known that
mm-hmm.
to be the case in the past. And what I heard you just say is that's really not the way to go.
It's not the way to go if you're somebody that needs to get in the 30s. If
mm-hmm.
you score in the 30s, you're not going to be able to do that. You have to read everything.
Mm-hmm.
Except on the science section. The science section is one of those sections that does the sort of thing where they offer more data than you actually need in order to answer the
yeah.
questions. So, and I think that's what angers people about standardized tests is they give you lots of data and
right.
you only need a couple little things to solve the question, and so you're wading through all of this exhausting material. That does not happen on the grammar and the math on this test, and the only time that it happens is in the science, just by virtue of them needing to present complete experiments that students can analyze.
Uh-huh.
So, and that's a place then where the strategy of not reading everything can actually be helpful, because reading everything can bog you down, specifically because the pacing of the test is brutal. Truthfully, it's very difficult to get through.
Well, you talk about memorization, and I thought that was an interesting topic. I'm glad you did that. Talk a little bit about it, because so often students feel like, you know, do I need to memorize this theory, that theory, or not? Or is it not necessary?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think you address that.
I know you know where I'm going with this. Here's the thing about memorizing stuff is it's completely true that it's tedious, tough, boring, stinks.
Mm-hmm.
That's the fact. But if we want to be people that are able to think completely about things that we have never seen before, the best way to do that, to equip ourselves to do that sort of thinking, is to have everything that we could possibly use at our fingertips in a reflexive way. So if I'm going to try to solve some crazy parabola formula, I don't want to have to stop and look up in my calculator what that parabola formula is, because looking up the formula prevents me from thinking about the question.
Hold your thoughts for just a second. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm talking with Elizabeth King. We're going to take a brief break. Acing the ACT, Elizabeth King, internationally renowned tutor, shares secret insights for unlocking solutions to the trickiest questions on the ACT. Elizabeth, I had to interrupt you. We were talking about memorization. I wanted you to continue your thought on that.
Well, I think that ultimately memorization is the key to kind of creating a web of knowledge in your brain that you can use to address anything that you're doing in your real life.
Mm-hmm.
And I love to bring anything that we're doing for ACT or SAT prep back out into the real world, because that's what actually matters. So even thinking about Google search, right, any kind of internet search, though it's difficult to do internet search if you are not already somewhat familiar with the topic that you're researching, because
right.
you need to know how to frame your question. So that means that we all have to memorize things so that we have information and data at our fingertips, so that then when we're approached with a next level question mm-hmm. that uses that material, we don't have to use our brain power to go back to the fundamentals and sort out the fundamentals, because it's something you could have just looked up. So while there are many things that you could just look up, you either are going to waste time looking them up, or you don't know that you should look it up because you don't recognize it. And so in that way, you give yourself a disadvantage. And that's true on the ACT, and that's true in any sort of academic, research-based, creative work. Because the way we really accomplish creativity in our lives is also by connecting things that we already know. So the only way to know things is to memorize them. You have to commit them to your brain. Unfortunately for all of us, that's usually a pretty boring thing, but that's the way the world works.
Yeah. Well, I know you're acing the ACT. It's basically, it's a prep guide for the ACT, and it offers and features concise lessons as to how to boost your scores dramatically. Why are these strategies so effective? And how do they differ with other techniques that are touted to be the answer to test taking?
They differ from other techniques because they're actually effective.
Mm-hmm.
Because they rely on the student learning something and then applying it in a systematic way. It strips away all the mythology around the test being something that's frightening or out to get you,
mm-hmm.
or that the test makers are people that are, you know, up in their evil tower in the sky trying to confuse you. It's really just about understanding very clearly, here's the rule that you need to know, and here's the way that they most frequently present that. I think that's incredibly valuable, and I think the reason that people have trouble applying strategies in other manners of approaching the test is because most of the time they're really missing the fundamental that they need to apply the strategy anyway. You can't apply a strategy if you don't have the fundamental.
Right.
Most students don't have a grammar course in school anymore. So a lot of the time when I'm teaching real grammar and sentence structure and how punctuation works and why we use it and when we don't, unfortunately, that's late-breaking news to even the most advanced students.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually honor them intellectually by bothering to teach them things that they should know. I think it's a really affirming and empowering thing to know what you need to know. And then you go into the test much more confident because you know what's going on instead of thinking, well, I'm going to game this thing one way or another, even though it's out to get me. That's what makes people's scores jump. They recognize what they need to know, and they answer the question, and they get on with it.
As we look at English, and I think that's a good place to start, do you find that the smartphones and texting have had any type of influence on our whole grammar, writing at all?
I think you would have to be crazy to imply that it hasn't.
Okay.
I think it's the strangest thing in the world that so often, especially kids, speak to each other over text, right? They never, all they do is write things down,
mm-hmm.
but they never write things down properly. They just write what they hear. So a classic example of that, as it shows up on the ACT, is, you know, we say to each other, oh, we should have gotten together last weekend. And all the time, I have adults that text this. All the time people will say, oh, we should have,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? But what we're saying is I should have apostrophe.
We should have.
I should have. Yeah, but that most people don't know that. So, of course, it's going to be on the ACT, as are all the sorts of punctuation that format whether clauses are primary or subordinate and what, you know, pronouns, who's referring to what at what time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the more we text, the less that we're able to accomplish this section and scores are going down.
Interesting about the ACT that I read is where it is used. They find that it's more prevalent in the southern states, in the Midwest, and the Rocky Mountains. Are you familiar with that? Have you heard that? And I was just going to ask you why.
That was definitely the case 25 or 30 mm-hmm. years ago, but
mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure that that's changed.
Okay.
I mean, I would say that out of the students that I meet with, maybe one in five of them chooses to take the SAT right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I can promise you that no matter what the numbers are right now, because the SAT is going to change so dramatically this coming fall with the PSAT, and because the test is going to be completely overhauled next year,
mm-hmm.
people are jumping ship. I don't care if they're on Cape Cod or they're in Milwaukee. People are going to be taking the ACT in mass quantities.
Now, the ACT is also going to be computerized. Is that right? Talk about that. That's this year, right?
Yeah, it's tough for me to talk about it because I don't know a whole lot
about
it,
okay.
Believe it or not. I just know that the content of the test is not going to change very
mm-hmm.
much. It's just that it's going to be on the computer. I can't actually say that much more about it yet because I haven't seen an iteration of it on screen.
Do you feel
I don't think that it's going to be any different.
Okay. Yeah. And I from what I understood, it's not going to be any different, but it's just going to be computerized.
Like on a regular testing center.
Like in a regular testing center. And I guess there are still a number of schools that will be doing the pen and paper and pencil version.
Right. That's
because
right.
They don't have...
I'm thinking it can't possibly be that different.
Mm-hmm.
Because most students will still be taking it with a number two pencil. Yeah.
How do you feel about the multiple choice test? I mean, just what's your feeling on that? Because, for example, some schools don't use multiple choice testing at all.
I don't understand how that's possible. Don't we make multiple choice decisions in our lives all the time where you're faced with options and you need to narrow them down and see what works and see what, analyze them moment by moment? We were talking about this earlier a little bit with, getting rid of two. There's usually two that are absolutely terrible and then, the other two answer choices will be choices that have minute differences and they need to be analyzed. I feel like that's what happens all day long in terms of the ingredients that I shop for in my kitchen and, the boyfriends that I date. I mean, this is the way that we think about everything is I have lots of different options. I really need to learn how to think about these options carefully and on a detail-based level.
Those who oppose it say, multiple choice questions stifle creativity. It limits you to looking at it from this perspective and that only, to answer the test. Okay. So that's why I asked you, because often when you talk to individuals who are into psychometrics, they have a strong feeling about multiple choice versus essay, looking at it.
If you're somebody that's taking multiple choice tests for 10 hours a day full time, then yeah, I think that's entirely possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I consider myself to be a deeply creative person and a creative writer and a thinker about education and culture, and I'm an artist, and I spend more time dealing with multiple choice tests than I'm almost anybody that I know. I think all they do, if you approach them properly, is they're a way to analyze new information, and then that skill gets used in other places. The real creativity is nothing more than making new connections between information with which you're deeply familiar. That's all it is. It's not, painting a blue pony, unless the blue pony is the connection that you're making. But other than that, creativity is also this mythologized thing where we think about it as, the angel bonks you on the head and you have this brilliant idea, but it's not. It's your brain connecting things that it knows and has analyzed and thought about and sees in a new light. And a multiple choice test can't kill that. I do not accept that.
Okay.
It's just one detail of the way we learn to think about things. If you do them exclusively, sure, but does anybody?
No.
I don't think so.
And looking at the ACT, let's look at the who, when, where. Who takes it? When should they take it? Let me ask you that. Who takes it? Meaning, at what point, whether they should be a sophomore or a junior. So when should they take it?
Junior year. I mean, you really want to think about it in terms of how many college applications you're going to be writing as well. And also wanting to free yourself up so that you know that when you're taking the test, you in theory could always take it again. You would never want to wait until the December of your senior year to take the test because you're going to have incredible pressure to not screw up that one time. So oftentimes, depending on the kind of preparation that a student would have, I would say optimally they would take it for the first time maybe in the winter of their junior year, and if not, then April of junior year. So they would take it, a lot of times they get June, like April, June, and then that frees them up to take a fall test.
Mm-hmm.
Or worst comes to worst, two fall tests.
Okay, let's look at, in these last few minutes that we have, I wanted to look more closely at really the test composition. I mean, we have the English, the math, the reading, and the science, and the optional writing. In math, we mentioned earlier that you really need to know the fundamentals. So you've got to come in there knowing the fundamentals. And often students seem to, when they're taking math exams, math tests, they seem to waste a lot of time. And I wanted to know, from your perspective, how do students waste time in taking math assessments?
I think students waste time because they're not prepared and because they're panicking. I think also the way that the test works is that in the way students understand that the way the test works is that it gets incrementally more difficult question by question. So there's 60 right. math questions, and say I'm stumped on number 42. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of students will sit and stare at number 42, presuming mm-hmm. that number 43 is going to be that much more difficult. So they don't even think that they should work forward because, well, everything gets harder. So I think it's important to understand that the way that that difficulty is measured by is by the number of students that would get any particular question wrong. And while number 52 or 53 is tricky, number 54 might feel really easy to some students. So you don't want to sell yourself out and get bogged down when every question is worth a single point. So moving forward and getting on with it is actually really key, because a lot of students will be able to work through even question number 60.
And
number 60 might even just ask a an algebra question.
Right. Well, I was just going to say, and sometimes those questions, the next question might help you with the previous question.
With the previous question.
Yes. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, so,
right.
You know, when you get stuck. How about writing down all your work, showing all your work? Is that important in the math section?
It's wildly important. I think that the way to take this test is to treat it like the way your seventh grade math teacher would want you to. You know, mm-hmm. she always said, write down all your work. And we perceive that students that are really good at math are people that don't have to write anything down. And I say jettison that whole idea when you're taking this test, because you're going to be more anxious anyway. And when you write down all your work, it's kind of like an insurance policy for your head. You can see what's going on in your head.
Exactly.
You're more likely to see errors. And then once your work is mm-hmm. written down, you're going back and checking it. If you don't write down your work, you're doing the problem twice, which is an entirely different thing. I think it's crazy not to write anything down. And I never ask my students to do anything that I don't personally do.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not a math whiz that's just not doing any of this. I write it down every time, even though I can get a perfect score and usually not write it down.
And
it's
I know
insane not to.
And I think you raise a couple really valid points in that if you write it down, you can see maybe where you may have mm-hmm. made a mistake. When you don't write mm-hmm. it down, you don't have that concrete, those numbers that you can look at and see, mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. equation that, oh, I blew it. I didn't mean that. So I think that that's very important. Let's look at mm-hmm. the reading. What is the key to doing well in this section?
The key to going to doing really well in the reading is, one, moving really quickly and knowing how, mm-hmm. knowing your personal pace. Understanding what your score goal is and making sure that you accomplish enough of the reading in order to hit that goal. So knowing on any given test that if you answer about 30 questions, you can usually get around a 27. So that's only doing 3 out of the 4 passages. Of course, you have to do it perfectly,
mm-hmm.
but you only need to do 3 out of the 4. And then second, really refining that ability to do that process of elimination that we were talking about earlier, that understands the nuanced ways that the particular test that you're taking can make answer choices wrong that you may overlook not having had that kind of training. So pacing and a real process of elimination strategy,
mm-hmm.
and remembering that it's not a test of your reading ability, it's a test of your ability to get to the same answer as
exactly.
the test maker.
Exactly.
Which is a different
thing. That's a
thing.
Different thing. That's a whole different thing. And I always tell students to, in looking at a reading passage, you want to look, and you can correct me, I may be wrong, you want to look at the tense, whether they change from past to present, because that can also change the whole perspective of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You agree?
Yeah, I always say the same thing as
okay.
well. And
okay.
that's part of critical thinking, right?
Uh-huh.
Is understanding
exactly.
the context of what it is you're looking at and what the objective is of the piece that you're looking at. Absolutely.
Science. Let's look at science very quickly. What are some keys that you would suggest for those taking the science?
Don't read anything but other than the brief introduction at the start of the start of each experiment, and then start answering the questions, and then only read as you need to. One, because you're likely to get really bogged down and not remember what you read anyway. And two, a lot of times you don't actually need to read the entire material. And I found I'm somebody that usually can do a standardized test in about 50% of the allotted time. And the first time that I took the ACT when I was in high school, I actually didn't finish because I was reading every word on the page because I thought that's just what you did. It's really about understanding pacing and keeping going. And if you get stuck, coming back to it, because usually you're overthinking it. It's just a test of reading graphs and charts.
In 20 seconds, can you just share a little bit about the essay?
Get the book. The essay is always create a new answer that agrees with the bigger gist of the question, but it frees you up to write a more loose and thorough essay than just yes or no. Always avoid just saying yes or no.
Okay. Elizabeth, thanks. It's been great. I really appreciate you sharing your insights. To my listening audience, tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.